Chapter 8. That's what friends are for. Why does Donald Trump have no friends? Perhaps the story of the Trump winery in 2011 will shed some light on the matter of what it's like to be his friend. For years, Trump had been friends with John Kluge, a media conglomerate billionaire in the 1980s and once one of the wealthiest and best-known men in America. He'd topped the Forbes list as the richest man in the world in 1984. Kluge had accumulated the collection of independent TV stations that would eventually be put together to form the Fox network under Rupert Murdoch, and Kluge had moved in the same social circles in Palm Beach and New York that Trump inhabited. Kluge also shared the boss's propensity for messy divorces. By the 1980s, Kluge's third wife was named Patricia, a former nude model with a faux upper-class British accent who'd married a man nearly 3 decades older than her, only, inevitably, to get divorced a few years later. In the settlement, the former Mrs. Kluge took possession of a house in Charlottesville, Virginia called Albemarle, along with a cash settlement of $100 million. The house wasn't a mansion. It was whatever was bigger and more impressive than that, more like a castle. The 45-room colossus was surrounded by more than 200 acres that she turned into a vineyard making fine, sparkling wines, a high-prestige, high-risk business. Like many divorcees or widows of wealthy men, she had expensive property and fancy jewelry and tastes, but not enough income to maintain the lifestyle she'd become accustomed to after she sold the rights to her annuity, so she ran up a mountain of debt that she couldn't sustain in the aftermath of the global financial crisis of 2008. Leveraging the vineyard to take out more and more loans, her wine company was soon forced into default by its bank. By 2010, she'd been compelled to hold 2 auctions to sell jewelry and furniture, raising $15 million, but even that sum hadn't kept Patricia Kluge from having to declare bankruptcy. This was a classic example of how Trump read the newspaper, for deals and opportunities, not the news. He'd figured she had to be a billionaire, so he was amazed when he came across reports of her destitute status. When she came to Trump Tower to meet the boss in 2011, it was instantly obvious to him that she was in deep trouble. And she was going to be in even deeper trouble in short order. A friend approaching Trump for assistance in a time of need was making a mistake of epic proportions. Trump doesn't help people, he preys on them. And buying the estates of the formerly super wealthy was a specialty of his, as his purchase of Mar-a-Lago illustrated. Beating down the price and taking advantage of people who'd once been wealthier than the boss gave him a kind of existential and karmic thrill. His crocodile tears and fake empathy for the downfallen ex-wife of a recently deceased good friend were preposterous. As I could see, his mind was spinning 1,000,000 miles an hour trying to figure out how to acquire the property for the lowest possible number. She was trying to sell the house and vineyard at auction for $100 million, but Trump told me there was no way he was going to pay that much, nor would anyone else. He was going to get it cheap, and his method of approach to such matters was to find a point of weakness to exploit. In this case, the Kluges had an adopted son who was also in financial distress, a common occurrence in wealthy families, Trump told me. Every family has a weak link, he believed. Trump learned that the land near the vineyard, including more than 200 acres that had to be crossed to get to the estate, was held in a trust for Mrs. Kluge's only son. Kluge's son is a complete mess, Trump told me as he explained what he'd done. He was desperate for money, so I bought the right of first refusal to acquire the land next to the vineyard for $500,000. Now I have a lien on the son's interest, and he won't be able to do anything with the property unless it goes to me. Holy shit, I thought. Classic Trump. He'd identified the weak link in his adversary, because that's what Patricia Kluge really was to him by now, and he was going to exploit it. Are you serious, boss? I asked. Yeah, Trump said. They can do whatever they want with the land, but they will have to deal with me. It's complicated, but the land and house are split into separate entities, and the land is the real value. The house is worth very little without the land surrounding it. Trust me, I am going to own this property on the cheap." Trump greedily flicked through a portfolio of photographs of Albemarle and the rolling hills of Virginia. The place really was spectacular. "This will be my next acquisition," he said. "Trump Winery." Applying the brutal logic of New York real estate, Trump arranged for no trespassing signs to be put up all along the road to greet visitors to the estate, and he let the grass go unmowed so that anyone driving up to view the potential investment would have to wonder about the manner in which the gateway property was kept, thus damaging the valuation and functionality of the estate as a place of business. With a lien on the adjacent land and no takers on land at the exorbitant price, coupled with a derelict neighboring property, Trump approached the bank then holding the remaining Kluge land through bankruptcy. By then, Kluge had gone bankrupt, making her even more vulnerable, as Trump knew from personal experience. Control of the land with the right-of-way easement for the only access to the estate did indeed make Trump the only possible buyer, the bank had to reluctantly admit. The bank was trapped, selling him the underlying land of the vineyard for $6.2 million plus $1.7 million for the equipment and inventory, far less than the $16 million paid at the foreclosure auction. This left the house, which was a separate parcel of property, and Trump had a plan for this stage of the game as well. "You know, Michael, I'm the only possible buyer for the house, too," Trump said. "I agree that the house has to be part of the land," I said, "but they could sell to someone who doesn't care about the acreage in front of the house." "No chance," Trump barked, opening up a map of the parcels of land to show me. "You drive in from the front gate. It's a 50-acre drive up to the house. I own all the land in front and on the sides of the house, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build a wall." "A wall?" I asked. "For what reason?" "I'm going to build a wall right in front of the house," Trump said. "I'm going to put up a 20-foot concrete wall with Trump Winery painted every 20 feet in massive letters. Can you imagine waking up in Kluge's mansion and looking out the fucking bedroom window and all you see is a concrete wall with my name on it?" Trump laughed. "Now there's a real fucking selling point," he said. "Holy shit," I said, out loud this time. "You just made a $50 million house worthless. Even worse for the bank, they have to maintain the house to make sure it's saleable in the meantime. They're going to have to spend real money." "Exactly," Trump said triumphantly. "I'm speaking to the bank later today. By the end of the day, I'll own the whole fucking thing." And so it came to pass. Trump bought the house for $6.7 million, making the total purchase price for the entire estate less than $13 million, when the asking price had been more than $100 million. There was an undeniable kind of genius to Trump's approach, a completely amoral will to win, no matter the cost, in this case, essentially taking away the Kluge's son's inheritance in one fell swoop. "Even better," Trump bragged to me as he celebrated his victory, "there were millions of dollars worth of excellent wine in the inventory of the vineyard, which he could rebrand as Trump Wines and sell in his golf courses and hotel bars. Yet another win." "What a deal," Trump said to me. "I just stole the property. In this case, someone else's loss is Trump's gain." He pulled out a bottle of wine. "Here's a bottle of red," Trump said. "Take it home and try it out with Laura. I hear it's the best sparkling red on the market." The story could end there, with Trump putting his son Eric in charge of the vineyard, but that was never how things went at the Trump Organization. Because get this, Trump made Patricia Kluge think he'd done her a favor. Seriously, she was bankrupted and walked away without a penny. Her son was essentially disinherited, despite once having a father who was the richest man on the planet, and somehow she was happy with the transaction. I knew Trump had hired her and her current husband to work for Eric at the vineyard with a one-year contract for $250,000, which he terminated at the end of the year, of course. Kluge had been ripped off by the worst jackal of them all, and she didn't even know it, and probably doesn't to this day. And she was grateful for being torn to shreds and devoured, a fact that boggled my mind. "My worst nightmare and personal Armageddon are finally over," she told the Daily Beast at the time Trump took over her vineyard. "I'm thrilled beyond belief. Now I can finally relax, take a week off, go on vacation." That was the real, real art of the deal, or steal. But don't get the impression Trump was always, or even usually, a rational player. He knew how to take advantage of others, but there was an essential foolishness, even idiocy, to insisting on getting his way all the time. Let me give you an example of his ruinous and relentless need to always win. Later in 2011, a lawyer friend of mine in Miami called to say that he was representing the Doral Golf Club in Miami in its Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. He wondered if this was a property that might interest the Trump Organization. I immediately knew this was a prospect the boss would want to hear about, so I asked my friend to send me the documents related to the Doral. Two large binders arrived the following day via FedEx, laying out the details and specifications for the impending sale of the property, one of the most prestigious clubs in the country and the home of the legendary Blue Monster course. It was also the site of a PGA tournament Trump was desperate to host. I read the terms of the proposed sale with growing excitement. The project didn't just suit Trump's portfolio of golf courses, it epitomized the themes of excellence and luxury together with a ton of history and prestige. Doral wouldn't just be another golf acquisition, it would become one of the pearls of the Trump Organization. I picked up the deal books, stepped over to Trump's office, and knocked on his door as usual. He waved me in the familiar way that happened dozens of times a day, and I sat and told him that I'd bird-dogged a deal through a business associate that put us in the inside position to buy Doral. Trump wasn't excited. He was thrilled. The look on his face when he got a dose of deal fever was always fun to behold, a mixture of delight and aggression and determination. Hitting the intercom button on his speakerphone, he called for Ivanka to come up from the 25th floor where the kids each had an office. I was about to learn another lesson about treachery and Ivanka and how the Trump family operated. For years, I had been very friendly with Ivanka. She was my neighbor at Trump Park Avenue, and when she was single, it wasn't unusual for her to stop over for a casual pasta dinner with my family. She loved my homemade lasagna. We joked around with each other, and she enjoyed the banter of business and gossip and the media. She wasn't like one of the bros, but she was no shrinking flower or delicate debutante. She wanted to be in business with the big boys, and her ambition and sharp elbows were evident. But she changed when she got involved with Jared Kushner, the scion of a New Jersey real estate family with its own history of troubles and woes. Kushner was supremely arrogant, a real snob, to be honest, with an exaggerated sense of his importance and intelligence. I would occasionally see him in the gym at Trump Park Avenue or at the office, but for the most part, he kept me at arm's length, which was more than fine with me. As I explained the Doral deal to Ivanka, I could see her eyes widening, much like her father's had. There was a way of conducting business inside the Trump Organization with nothing written down but an understanding that whoever brought a deal to the company got to work the deal. All deals were ultimately for the benefit and glorification of Donald J. Trump, of course, but finding attractive transactions was a way of keeping score and getting ahead. And this Doral acquisition promised to be a huge win for the company. For the most part, Ivanka worked her own brands, including her lines of clothing and handbags, but she and the other Trump children also wanted to do deals for the main company. After a few days, wondering when I was going to get word from the boss to proceed on Doral, my friend called to say that Ivanka had come down to Miami and started talks to buy the golf course, without so much as a word or a nod in my direction. As the deal proceeded, I was kept in the dark, with no explanation or justification or apology. That was how the Trumps worked, I was seeing, with guardrails around anything that might serve their interests. In this selfish and self-serving way, Ivanka was very much her father's daughter. My lawyer buddy commiserated, but business was business. The final price for the Doral Hotel and Spa was $150 million, financed by a loan of $125 million from Deutsche Bank, and a complete renovation was quickly undertaken at the cost of $250 million. The plan was a return to grandeur for the rundown resort. The multiple golf courses were to be redone, along with the hotel and pool area, with nearly 700 guest rooms reimagined in tasteful, minimalist, neutral colors, but with the Trumpian touch of gilded gold accents. When completed, Doral will be the finest resort and golf club in the country, Trump told the press. As the renovation continued, I discovered that despite the rhetoric, Trump was cutting corners, having cheap attacks, and screwing the many contractors and subcontractors who were working on the project. This wasn't unusual, and a significant part of my job description involved dealing with vendors the boss had decided to rip off. This behavior was part of what constituted loyalty to Donald Trump. Whatever he wanted done, I would do, no matter how dishonest or dishonorable. Trump saved the crappiest jobs for me, a fact that I took pride in. I was given the dirty work because I was willing to get dirt on my hands, and blood, if necessary. If that seems bizarre to you, think about it like being under the spell of a cult leader. I don't mean that as a cliche or an accusation. I mean literally. How did Jim Jones get his followers in Guyana to drink the poisoned Kool-Aid, actually it was a cheap knockoff called Flavor-Aid, and commit mass suicide? The answer was that Jones took control of the minds of those drawn to him, not all at once, but gradually, over time, by luring them into his mind. Stop drinking the Kool-Aid, we would say to each other at the Trump Organization all the time. The joke wasn't really a joke, even as we joshed around. Trump would say so many things that were illogical or just plain bullshit, as we consciously would know. But we would stay on his message, even though we knew it was nonsense. We would repeat what he said as if it were true, and then we'd repeat the message to one another so often that we would actually begin to believe the distortions ourselves. This mind meld is what I see every day as I sit in prison watching the nightly news from the White House. Trump's staff and advisors aren't all so stupid that they don't understand, for example, that extorting the president of Ukraine to investigate Democratic candidate Joe Biden is a terrible, terrible idea and precedent, or that downplaying a global pandemic might work for one news cycle but will only harm innocent people over time. But witness the politicians and media folks like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh making excuses for Trump, or saying he did nothing wrong. Or the pathetic spectacle of Rudy Giuliani committing harakiri for Trump, just like I used to do, somehow imagining that the fate that befell me and Roy Cohn won't happen to him, as if the rules of gravity have been suspended magically. Think of all the responsible and conservative and moral, even devoutly religious Trump supporters, not just rationalizing or explaining away his transparent dishonesty, but actually turning it upside down and saying it's perfectly normal. Franz Mesmer was a German doctor in the 18th century who believed in a phenomenon he called animal magnetism. He would mesmerize people using actual magnets, but Trump doesn't need any physical props to succeed in getting his followers to do what I did, virtually anything he wanted. Part of it was a function of loyalty, which led to willful blindness. There was also a fever-pitched desire to please that made me sycophantic, it's true to say. But there was another element that rarely gets discussed. Trump is a master at getting otherwise seemingly sensible people to enter into his fantasy land because of the fear that failure to do so means banishment. This explains the behavior of many members of Congress and the cabinet, as displayed daily in the news, terrified of facing a primary or a tweet or a tantrum. It was a huge part of a process that I fell victim to and know intimately. Once the small lies and delusions pass, then it becomes easier and easier to swallow bigger and bigger lies and delusions. I know this insanity up close and personal. Take the paint job during the renovation of the Doral. One afternoon in 2014, I was summoned to Trump's office. As I walked in, Trump was on a call with David Fader, the general manager of the Trump Doral, talking on the speakerphone. The pair were discussing the paint used in the renovation of the buildings and guest rooms at the Doral. When the House staff wiped down the walls of the rooms as part of a routine cleaning, it appeared that the fresh paint was coming off. The walls were becoming spotty and discolored and faded, only weeks after the new paint had been applied. "We just painted the entire goddamn place," Trump said to Fader. "I hear the rooms look like shit. Get the fucking painters back and make them redo the entire job. Tell them I'm not paying for their time or paint." Trump turned to me. "Michael just walked in. He will call you, and the two of you better figure this out." Trump hung up. Following orders, I went to my office and dialed up Fader to discuss a course of action to get the painters to correct the obviously poor job they had performed for the Trump Organization. I was already mustering my outrage, girding for battle, when David told me the truth. "I told him to not use that paint," Fader said. "What are you talking about?" I said. "What's going on here?" "Look, Michael," Fader said, "there are levels of quality involved in the Benjamin Moore paint the boss chose. We needed at least a level 3 quality. But the boss decided to go with the absolute cheapest level 1 paint, which is pure garbage. It requires more paint to cover the wall, but it also doesn't last. So that's the explanation. It wasn't meant for this kind of commercial job." I burst out laughing, at least initially. The situation was absurd. Trump had had a cheap attack and made a poor decision on the type of paint the contractor should use, which didn't surprise me in the slightest. Trump was constantly making errors, large and small, like pretty much any human being. The difference was that Trump would never acknowledge his errors. Hell, he wouldn't just deny his own mistakes, he'd blame others. Circular logic that best resembled a Mexican standoff that left everyone pointing their guns at each other, but never Trump. Does that sound familiar to you? For all the ridiculousness of the situation, I knew Trump was pissed and that I had to come up with a plan for my sake and for David's sake, a fact that we both understood intuitively. Going to Trump and telling him that he'd ordered the worst quality Benjamin Moore paint available would only result in our instant dismissal or a screaming fit with blame hurled in all directions except himself, with the net result that we would be back where we started, with a delusional proposition that had to be supported as fact, despite the blatantly obvious truth that it was a lie. Ring a bell? I sat at my desk and weighed the options. David emailed me the contract, and sure enough, the Benjamin Moore paint specified in the invoice was exactly as described. Super hide paint was well known in the industry as low quality and not meant to last. The super hide level was used to paint new houses that were going to be flipped, or by fly-by-night painters playing their customers for fools, or by clients foolish enough to cut corners. How on earth could I blame the contractor for using the paint specified by the customer? In normal circumstances, a complaint like this would be treated for what it was, idiotic. But not in the Trump Organization, I knew. I resolved to bluff my way through the problem like a gambler with a bad poker hand going all in. I called the painting contractor, introducing myself as Trump's special counsel and executive vice president, credentials that usually had the effect of grabbing people's attention. When I described the situation, the contractor was amazed, but also pissed that I was bringing up the quality of the paint. He explained that he had told the folks from the Trump Organization that Superhide was inferior and not suited to a project like Doral, with high use and the inevitable wear and tear of a hotel and golf club. The contractor then raised his own issue. He said that Trump hadn't paid for the work he'd completed, and he couldn't make payroll. He was barely making his costs on the job, and he needed to be paid in a timely fashion. I explained that payment wasn't my issue, but I could tell that I wasn't going to get anything from this small-timer struggling to keep his business alive. I decided to up the stakes. I was going to go after Benjamin Moore directly, I decided. When I called the company and identified myself, stressing as always my high-level positions, I was put through to the secretary of the CEO. The executive wasn't available, the secretary said, but I explained why I was calling in detail and told her that the Trump Organization had been sold faulty paint and demanded a refund. Assured I would receive a return call, I reported back to Trump, who immediately went into a rant about the shitty paint and how I needed to rectify the problem. "Michael, go do your thing," Trump said. "Don't disappoint me." The words hung in the air and then swirled around in my mind as I returned to my office. This was now on me? I didn't order the paint, Trump did. But that was how the flowchart worked in the Trump Organization. The buck didn't stop at Donald Trump's desk. It never got there. What "don't disappoint me" actually meant, I knew, was an implicit threat that I would be fired if I didn't somehow resolve a situation he had created to his satisfaction. All of the staff at the Trump Organization routinely joked about how any given day could be your last, pressure that you might think would drive us away, but in fact made us all the more determined to defend Trump and do what he wanted, no matter how morally or legally dubious. The return call from Benjamin Moore didn't come from the CEO. The Florida Director of Regional Sales was on the line, politely offering his assistance. "Nice to speak with you, Mr. Cohen," the director said. "Likewise," I replied. "We seem to have a problem with the paint Mr. Trump purchased for Doral." I read out the invoice and detailed identification of the paint and pointed out that the paint had proved to have been of extremely low quality. The paint came off the wall when washed and failed to adhere properly. The director promised to discuss the issue with the quality control department, but he assured me that the company stood behind its products 100%. "I appreciate your help," I said. "I suggest you call me back this afternoon because Mr. Trump is really angry, and he has asked me to make the resolution of this issue a priority." I knew the director was rattled. By this time, I had convinced myself that the paint actually was somehow defective. I know. I was sharing the Trump delusion. But that was the alchemy, and I see it traveling throughout the White House and beyond all the time. In defending the indefensible, you can't resort to reason or facts or good business practices. You can't appeal to conscience or justice or fairness. All that is left is what I resorted to and what Trump displays so often: rage. The next call followed that pattern. The director wanted to be reasonable. They had batch-tested the paint, he said, and it was fine for the level of quality of Superhide. He asked me to arrange for a gallon of the paint at Doral to be sent to their test lab to be assessed to see if it differed from the standard Superhide paint. He offered to pick up the gallon, if that was easier. He wanted to find a mutually agreeable solution, which made perfect sense. But I knew it meant that the contention that the paint was flawed would be shown to be a lie. Superhide was Superhide, after all. The director promised that the company would be transparent in determining the quality of the paint. He pledged his word. "Enough," I screamed inwardly. the only arrow I had in my quiver was the one I fired. I lost it. Take your pledge, which is worthless at this point. The paint is pure shit. It doesn't stick to the walls. It wipes off when the rooms are being cleaned. I took a breath. Here is what I want you to do. Go speak to whoever you need to speak to, then take out your checkbook and overnight to me a check with a full refund of all of our costs. The director replied that he had talked to both the contractor and the Trump representative who placed the order, and they confirmed that Superhide was the grade specified. Mr. Trump had personally made the decision after being informed of the quality issues such a cheap paint would inevitably have. Under the circumstances, with no proof of any issues related to the paint, it was impossible to offer any compensation. "You're going to challenge me?" I thought. "You know who you're talking to, buddy boy," I thought. "Fuck you, game on." "Is this your final decision?" I asked, now quaking with anger. "Let me play out the scenario for you and your entire executive team. Before close of business today, I will be instructed by Mr. Trump to pursue all legal rights and remedies in law and in equity against Benjamin Moore for the sale of your defective product. As with every lawsuit filed with a Trump trademark attached, significant media attention sadly becomes a reality, and statements from people like me and our public relations department will ensue. Are you really going to explain to your customers that you manufacture a paint that doesn't adhere to a wall? A paint that you can't maintain? A paint you can't stand behind? Or that Superhide is such a low classification that it should only be used for things like school projects?" I was indignant by then. Kind of like you see the president's defenders on the nightly cable talk shows, red-faced, nearly shouting, filled with righteous rage. "I don't think so," I said sarcastically. "I want you to explain to the public how you differentiate between products you will and won't stand behind with your Benjamin Moore 100% guarantee promise. Please, don't even try to respond. First, what you say I will not buy, and it will not be accepted by Mr. Trump. Second, I really don't care what you have to say. I was hoping to resolve this amicably and to be able to continue to do business with Benjamin Moore for our future needs. But now you throw this bullshit at me? No, thank you. Before we hang up, tell me the name of your counsel and tell me the correct address for the receipt of service of process for the company." Mr. Cohen, please wait," the director pleaded. "I never said I was finished. I was just telling you what corporate told me. Please, give me a little time to speak with them again. I'll call you back later today or tomorrow at the latest." "Fine," I said. "I will need to begin drafting the lawsuit in the meantime." Hanging up, I knew I was going to get a good resolution. I knew I was going to win. The only question was whether the offer Benjamin Moore was now going to make, as I felt sure they would be enough to satisfy the boss. The next call began with the director defending the company's stellar reputation. He said the company disagreed with my statements and how I had characterized its business ethics, pausing, and then continuing, "But in these circumstances, he had been instructed to find a resolution." I knew better than to make the first offer. As a personal injury and medical malpractice attorney, I learned to always let the other side shoot first. The first offer served as the floor for future talks. After a lot more back and forth, it was agreed that Benjamin Moore would give us 10,000 gallons of paint for free to compensate for the poor quality Superhide. The wholesale price for the better quality paint was around $30 a gallon more than Superhide, so the amount was substantial. The snag was that we had no need for so much paint, let alone anywhere to safely store several semi-trailer loads of paint. As a gesture of my generosity and reasonableness, I suggested as a solution that the company give the Trump Organization a credit for the 10,000 gallons to be used over time. The director was thrilled with this idea, and as soon as I had an email confirming the arrangement, I went to see Trump. When I walked in, Trump was on the speakerphone, which he placed on mute when I put the printed email on his desk. I told him what had happened, with a real sense of pride. Trump chuckled. "This is great," he said. "I just wanted to see if you could get something from Benjamin Moore. I didn't expect this. Great job." I floated back to my office, as usual, after receiving his praise. This episode encapsulated my decade as Donald Trump's personal lawyer. The lie turned into a delusion, turned into a supposed reality, and then a grievance, followed by more lies, more bullying, and ultimately the ruthlessness of New York real estate, where lying and cheating and stealing are the order of the day, unleashed on folks with no clue about the depravity and dishonesty of the TV star and self-styled mogul. But that wasn't the end of the Doral story, not by a long shot. The painting contractor eventually walked off the job, no doubt in frustration at not being paid in a timely fashion. Scores of small contractors have had to sue Trump over the years to try to get justice against a billionaire who has absolutely no compunction about screwing the little guy. I know, because I was often the one tasked with doing such low-life things to innocent and honest business people providing goods and services to the Trump Organization. I hated myself for what I did, even as I did it, but that didn't stop me, and I have no excuses to offer. But you might detect a theme that applies to the politics of today. Trump's version of loyalty is one way, as I famously learned, just like so many others have, indeed, like the nation has. But loyalty to Trump means the willingness to do things you know to be wrong and that are harming others. With Trump, there was always the domino effect. When he screwed one small business, he would hurt others, the impact cascading into family-owned companies struggling to make ends meet. The same thing happened in Miami, only this time one businessman fought back. After the fiasco with the Superhide paint, the contractor quit, and this, in turn, led to an unpaid local paint supplier named The Paint Spot suing and putting a lien on the entire Doral property. The claim was for $32,000 in paint that was never paid for by Trump Endeavor, the entity operating the resort. As always, Trump's litigators in Florida fought the case tooth and nail, threatening the business owner with ruinous legal costs just as he was about to give a deposition. "Let's play ball," the owner Juan Carlos Enriquez said as NBC News reported in 2017. I wasn't shocked when I read the press report. I was still on the inside in Trump's world, more of that story down the road, but I knew as much as anyone the real truth of his business ethics or lack thereof. The story described how Enriquez had run up huge legal bills with his own attorney, a risk that he'd dealt with by putting the lawyer on contingency, which was easy for the attorney to do because the claim for non-payment was so obviously valid. In the end, Enriquez had incurred nearly $300,000 in legal fees, a sum he couldn't possibly pay. "This is a company that just started," Enriquez said. "Where am I going to get $300,000? I would have gone bankrupt." Not that Trump would have cared. That was the whole point of the Trump legal strategy: to make it impossible for the little guy to stand up for his rights. And make no mistake, the lack of ethics applied equally to his three children, despite Ivanka's carefully tended image. All of them are like jackals when it comes to harming innocent business people. After winning the case, getting a judgment against Trump for non-payment, plus the large legal bill, Enriquez said he was going to open another paint store. But there was one challenge, according to NBC News. "I still haven't gotten my money," Enriquez told the NBC reporter.